tonight I'm very happy to welcome back Deanna Lam. She is the author of Becoming Peers, and tonight she will be giving a talk on coming of age ceremonies as preventative medicine. Thank you for coming tonight.
My pleasure. It's good to be back. Mm-hmm. All right. So we have a small group. So I'm curious to start by hearing from you. What brought you and what are you drawn to and what do you want to listen to? I definitely have various aspects I can dive in from, and I'm really interested in what brought you here and what is it that you'd like to get out of tonight.
I was invited by Alma, and yes. I'm not exactly sure what it's on, but she thought it would be good for me, and she said it's empowering, so.
All right.
And it, yeah, she was very, mm-hmm. she enjoyed the last one very much, so she thought I should come.
Welcome.
I'm so excited to be here.
Welcome.
Yes, I was surprised by the last talk, and I wasn't sure how it's going to go, and I was going to implement things, but I haven't.
Uh-huh.
So I'm hoping after, you know.
All right, give you some more encouragement.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, very good.
I have so many questions, but I think that maybe the question that I'm sitting with is around what is an appropriate, what's an appropriate way to celebrate the passage, the passage around blood rights when a girl begins to bleed, in your mind, like how do you see that passage working, and also like the intergenerational aspect of things, like in creating programming around this, it's often, I think, a really important piece is having a community to hold that passage, and what is the role of the parents and what is not the role of the parents in that transition.
Okay.
That girls are going through.
Yeah.
Yes.
All right. Very good. I will touch on all of those.
Okay.
Yeah.
For me, I'm interested in not the passage as a young woman, but as an older woman.
Yes.
And how to make the transition into an elder. And,
yes.
And how to, because we're not taught how to be old.
Yeah.
Either a ritual or some kind of passage.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Something.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Very good. Okay. We'll touch on that as well.
In me, like at the end of your last talk, I kind of had this feeling like, what about me? I really enjoyed your last talk. And one of the things that struck me, I've heard a lot of, not a lot, but, you know, a few different people speak on this topic, and there's usually that kind of confrontation between like men and women that they're sort of either intentionally or just kind of like covertly advocating, and I didn't pick any of that up in your talk, so I was kind of struck by that. And as I said, feeling like I was left out of something kind of fun or interesting. So, if you have anything while you're talking tonight to say about a man's role mm-hmm. in this process for others, that
yes.
would be
yep.
interesting.
Yeah.
But if not, then I still enjoy.
I think it's important, and I think there are lots of parallels. I mean, obviously there are the physiological changes that are unique to each gender, but there is lots of parallels in that both girls and boys are not welcomed and are not held as they come of age. So even though my focus is the changes in a woman's body and how the community of women can hold that for the girls, there are lots of parallels and ways to implement that for the men and the boys. So I will definitely touch on that. I think that it is important. And a lot of people always come to me and say, well, what about the boys? And I believe that a man needs to work with the boys, you know,
mm-hmm.
just because I grew up in a woman's body, it gives me a different perspective. And growing up in a man's body needs an elder man to welcome that rather than a woman.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, but I'll draw the analogy. Yeah.
Good, thank you. Yeah, are you also saying that, like, men should step back and let women take care of the process for maturing girls?
I think there are roles for men when girls mature and for women when boys mature, but specifically for the rite of passage of the first blood, I think that this is something that needs to happen in the company of women and girls, because it's a visceral experience that men don't share. So, you know, it just by definition, it's not a first-hand experience. So, yeah.
I think there is a way for men to support from the outside, though.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like we need our men to be holding that container and to be welcoming and accepting that girl into her womanhood, you know, and the being aware. I think it's important for a man to be aware of what's happening in this girl's life and to be embracing it and to not be scared of the words like moon blood or menstruation or that time of the month, that it's like, it's really like liberating. You know, for me, when I've been in communities where men are really able to talk about that and say, oh, you're on your moon, do you need some time? You know, do you need to take a break? Can I get some tea for you? So there is a way that I think that men can be really, really supportive of creating that culture, but maybe not like on the insides of like the, you know, the specific like ritual aspect of the rite of passage. But I'm also thinking of in the Apache culture, when the girls get their moon, they go with the women and they're there for days and days. But then when they come out, the father of the girl has carved her a staff that he then gives her, and she dances with that staff, and that's her first dance when she comes out. And that's symbolizing her dancing with spirit, that her first commitment is to spirit or God or whatever, you know, the mystery. And then once she puts that stick aside, then she can dance with the boys and anyone else she wants to in the celebration. But there is, like, I just love that image of, like, you know, her father, like, kind of handing her that masculine staff, like the symbol of the masculine in, like, a really healthy, strong way. So, so I think there are supportive roles.
Absolutely. Yeah, all right. So, so wanting to delve into the concept of coming of age ceremonies as preventive medicine. So, I'll start with a confession. I've been doing this work for many, many years, and I have been so immersed in the emotional benefits of doing this work that I have kind of overlooked the obvious, which are the physical benefits. And sometime in late August, I was a guest of Dr. Christian Northrop's radio show. And as we were talking, she spoke of the work as preventive medicine at its best. And I was really dumbfounded. And that's my confession here, is that I was really struck by the fact that I was overlooking the obvious by really holding the emotional aspects only of this healing work. I was overlooking the physical ones, and the connection is really obvious. I mean, looking at the fact that working with women for the past 20 years, some of whom have been doubled up with PMS pain, and as they learn to honor their cycle and to embrace it and to welcome it every month, their symptoms lessen and lessen and lessen all the way until going away. Well, obviously, but now looking back at the preventive aspect of it, realizing that if we don't journey back to the kernels of our own coming of age, if we weren't welcomed, if we weren't empowered, if we weren't witnessed as girls moving into womanhood, and as men, as boys moving into manhood, and if we were exposed to an array of cultural negativity about women's bodies and about menstrual cycles and about the actual substance of the blood, then in a way we continue to carry that with us. And creating something different for our girls from the word go would create a scenario, a preventive scenario, whereby they wouldn't have to carry that with them in their cellular memory, in their actual cells, all the way to young womanhood, and then come to heal it because they find themselves in excruciating PMS pain or what have you. So that's kind of, you know, the circle of going back to today's girls. But where I want to start is with what's going on inside of us, regardless of our age. You know, you spoke of the rites of passage on the other end. So regardless of our age. So women ask me, you know, they say, you know, women have been empowered, have been broken through glass ceilings and have been empowered professionally and have, you know, a lot of personal and political power more than they have ever been. So what else is missing? So what I'm wanting to look with a magnifying glass at is the kernel of coming of age, the time when we first started our period as girls. And again, regardless of our age, that moment in time happened for everyone. What was missing there, or what was embraced there? You know, usually I don't hear many empowering stories. Some do, and it's really delightful to sometimes come across some young women, especially younger women, that have positive stories. I don't see many women my age that have been welcomed, but in the younger generation there would be one or two that would say, yes, you know, I actually was welcomed and I was celebrated, and that's very refreshing. But the majority of women have not been welcomed, and for that matter the majority of boys have not been welcomed. So one of the things I would encourage you to think is not only about the lack of welcoming, but what were the messages. And it may be that the messages about manhood are a little bit more covert, because this is a society where in which men, you know, by and large are top dog. So there aren't that many overt messages that would diminish manhood. But there are many messages.
Except that's top dog and I'm not. That's kind of
That and also you know, the very kind of straight jacket of what manhood is, you know, that emotionality and vulnerability and what have you might not fit into that little pigeonhole of what manhood is. So inviting you to think of what were the messages that as you were growing up were given to you about what does it mean to be man. And for us, for as women, you know, there is a lot of messages about what does it mean to be woman, and what does it mean to cycle, what does it mean to be sensual, what does it mean to be sexual. A lot of messages around uncleanliness, dirtiness, you know, Jewish tradition definitely, there is a lot of dirtiness and uncleanliness that's directly associated with the moon blood, and the culture at large. So looking at all of those messages and looking at how a girl grows up, and in many ways there is lots of research to support that up until say 9 years of age, girls are pretty full of themselves and pretty kind of strong in their self-esteem, and then pretty much around puberty and when they start getting their first period, they start shutting down, so they lose their voice. One of the things that Christian Northrop talks about is that when the second chakra opens, when a girl starts bleeding, the second chakra opens, and the fifth chakra, the voice, often closes. So there is an openness and a closing, and the closing has to do with societal messages and attitudes around that. So girls often lose their voices. It would be interesting to think about whether it is the same with boys, I'm not sure. Maybe yes, maybe no. But there is a lot of evidence to support that girls really are losing their voice around that time. So then what happens is there is this young maiden that was coming up towards bloom, just starting to open her petals, and then there is a shutting down. And then there are years of puberty and adolescence that, you know, we all know that are kind of difficult for both boys and girls. And then all of a sudden on top of that there is women's empowerment. So then, yes, they can go out and they can be who they want to be and they can become professional and they can do a lot of stuff that their moms or grandmothers certainly couldn't do. So then there is another tier of openness and of empowerment, and women become moms, so they might be empowered as mothers. And what's missing in that picture is that young maiden that was coming to bloom was cut off, and then somewhere on the second floor there is some empowerment that is kind of starts relating to an older young 20s, you know, and a young woman, and there is somewhere in between that is missing. There is some part there that is missing. And what I find when I work with women on reclaiming the maiden that was not welcomed into womanhood is that, if you like, Amazon archetype, that fearless young woman, that archetype of innocence and yet vision and a willingness to go forward for her vision, has never been allowed to bloom, has never been allowed to fully open her petals and bloom. And that missing piece, journeying back into that girlhood, that maidenhood, and picking up those threads, allows women to make a bridge between that part of them that has been squelched and then since then has been dormant and kind of hiding inside, that girl inside each of us that has not been welcomed, that has waited all these years, can breathe, can open up, can start, can continue her process of blooming and start coming out into the world. And then there is the process of integrating her into the women that we became. So then we come full circle and reclaim the bloom out of the, you know, if you like, mature tree that we became, the oak that we've grown to be, and bringing in the flowers that never got to bloom. And again, if I'm looking at boys, you know, that would be a potent question of in what areas of a young man or an older man's life does he feel in his power and comfortable in his body and comfortable in his psyche, and what parts of him might have been left behind in the shadow, in shame about masculinity, that can be brought up and reclaimed by journeying to that juncture in time of the transition from boyhood to manhood. I know sometimes I talk with men and they speak about the breaking of the voice. You know, there's lots of memories there. So those times, those transitions might have a lot of emotionality around them that has not been explored. And by exploring that, and bringing it to light and soothing those parts of us would allow an integration of a greater self to be present as an adult. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So let me tell you about my story. A lot of people ask me how did I start and how did I come to that. And I grew up with a very similar upbringing. I grew up in Israel, but very similar messages. My mom was very scientific in her approach to menstruation and to procreation in general. I got a very scientific book and received all the information, but had no heart connection to the information. And then when I got my first period, I had no idea. It didn't click. All the information that she gave me and what was actually happening didn't click at all. I didn't make that connection. Which again is interesting, because I hear even today a lot of girls are speaking about, oh, my mom bought me a book and I know everything. But it seems that the intellectual information doesn't really sink in when there is no context and there is no emotional seedbed there for it to grow on. So, like most women, I've seen my period as a nuisance and a curse, and you know, something bother, something that I wasn't really particularly definitely didn't enjoy it, and I wasn't particularly wanting to even go there, and just wanted to get it over and done with as quickly as possible every month. And then some close to 20 years ago, I was traveling with my partner in Northern California. We lived in San Diego at the time, and we came upon a health food store, and there were menstrual cloth pads, which I've never ever heard of before. And I was really intrigued. I mean, it was very much like, you know, the rags of our grandmothers, and I was intrigued, why would anyone want to use cloth? And I read a brochure that said, had a testimonial from a woman that said that ever since she started using the cloth, she started anticipating her menstrual time with joy. And I thought, yeah, right, I did not believe that at all, but I was intrigued enough that I decided to try it, because I definitely was not having any joy around my period. I didn't have a lot of physical discomfort, but I had a lot of emotional irritability and kind of emotional discomfort. So I decided to try, to give it a try, and that's where this journey for me started close to 20 years ago. So it was, I didn't know what I was getting myself into, because it was a whole mindquake, if you like, because I needed to face the fact that I need to develop a relationship with my blood, that from this thing that my mom said wrap up in newspaper and put in the trash as quickly as you can and take it out to the trash outside, don't even leave it in the house, all of a sudden there is a cloth that I needed to soak in water, and I needed to handle, I needed to touch. And I read about the invitation to give this to my houseplants, because what is the substance that our womb sheds? It is a lining, and the inner lining of our womb, that would nourish a fetus when it grows. So even in this menstrual phobic society, no one in their right mind would think that the lining of the uterus that grows a baby is gross. That would be, of course, sacred. But then, as soon as a woman decides not to conceive, all of a sudden that same substance, the same tissue that would have been life-giving and nourishing to a baby becomes gross, becomes something that we don't want to know about, we have to wrap and discard, and it's trash, basically. So there's something wrong with that picture. I mean, how can something change overnight? I mean, it's not trivial. So obviously, that was intriguing enough for me to try. So I soaked my pads and I gave my blood to my houseplants, and it was amazing. Within the first cycle, they shot up. They've never been fertilized. I have never seen a fertilizer that worked as effectively. Since then, I don't know if you've heard, but since then, in various parts of the world, scientists are finding that menstrual blood is one of the highest sources of stem cell. Do you all know about that?
Yes.
Yeah, in Japan, they're finding it out. In this country, in Europe, there is evidence that's coming from various parts of the world. And once you think about it, I mean, it makes sense. It is the tissue that would, you know, give life and would nourish life. So obviously it makes a lot of sense. And it's interesting that eventually science went and explored there. And, you know, I had some people were saying, well, now what are they going to think of? Are they going to buy it from us? You know what? How are they going to harness that? So that's interesting. But the fact that this is coming from research from various independent sources is very interesting. So it's something that, again, the sages knew all along. And yet here the science is meeting ancient knowledge. If we're touching on ancient knowledge here, every single indigenous culture around the world had revered menstruation as a life-giving substance, as much as it revered women as being able to give life. So without bleeding, without menstruation, life cannot be produced. So obviously what we're shedding is the substance that has the egg that was not fertilized. So without shedding it, we would not be able to then ovulate again and release another egg. So the cycle of life is such that a woman's body releases an egg to be fertilized, and when it's not, it releases all of these nutrients and this life-giving substance that would have otherwise nourished a baby to fertilize the earth, you know, to be used in any other way. So I don't know enough about how the substance was used in indigenous cultures, but I do know a lot about the fact that women did sit in sacred spaces when they menstruated in indigenous cultures. So in Native American tribes, it was the Moon Lodge. You all maybe know about Anita Diamant's book, The Red Tent. The fact that that book became such an international bestseller, to me, speaks of the fact that women really recognize in a cellular memory level that, yes, there is a memory there, that we have sat together and bled together in ancient times. In Ethiopian cultures, in various African cultures, there are moon huts where women go. And throughout the indigenous cultures of the world, what the premise is such that it is considered that menstrual time is considered to be the time where the veil is thinnest between the worlds, where the woman is the most connected to the mystery, to spirit. And as such, she is not supposed to do any mundane daily work. She's not supposed to be moving her focus from the divine to daily chores. So then when women move to sit when they bleed in moon huts or moon lodges or red tents, they first of all be rather than do. So there isn't the daily chores, there aren't the daily tasks. And if you're thinking of indigenous culture, there were lots of tasks and life was mostly manual work. So the manual labor is subtracted from their existence. So there is an opportunity once a month to just sit and be rather than do. And any woman that bleeds knows how important it is to just be, to not just continue plowing through the daily chores and contemporary work as if nothing, because it's not as if nothing, because, you know, our body and our psyche and our emotional body need the rest and need replenishing. So what happens is that if we allow it, the replenishment, if we allow it the space and the time and the quiet and the solitude to go within, then there is no symptoms, because by design menstruation is not supposed to hurt. I mean, there isn't any purpose. When there are pains, they have purpose, and pain usually its purpose is to kind of tag at our skirt and say, hey, listen to me. And what happens is that when we don't listen and we don't take time and we don't retire out of the hustle bustle of daily life and continue to push on as if this is another day as any other day, then our body starts speaking to us with symptoms. And those are the PMS symptoms, those are irritability symptoms, mood swings. All of those are ways of the body flagging to us to pay attention. And what's ironic is that women that I see that are really in deep pain would take an enormous amount of painkillers and then would not be able to, even with those painkillers, not be able to go to work, so would be home for a few days. But rather than being home in sacred space and in connection, they would be home despite it all, medicated, stopping, but stopping in pain rather than stopping in joy. So, you know, this is so painful to think of. You know, because if we're gonna take the time anyway, might as well take it without the pain. But yes, without the pain, society doesn't allow us. So it is skewed. So I invite women to take at least the first day and kind of block that out. Most women know pretty much when they're going to be cycling next. If you don't, I would encourage that you do track your cycle, and it's always interesting to track it in relation to the moon phases. Some women ovulate on the full moon and bleed on the dark moon. Some women, it is the opposite. Some women cycle throughout the year. I cycle throughout the year. I have a moon calendar. Do you carry those moon calendars where you have all the moons of the year on one? That's a wonderful tool to be looking at and marking your period so that you see a year worth of periods. And I've been tracking my cycle since 97, and I have a stack of them, and it's really interesting to see that my pattern is a wandering one, that I'll start bleeding on the new moon, and then the next month it would be a couple of days later, and a couple of days later, and then in a few months it would be on the full moon, and then again goes to the dark moon. So it's a very distinct pattern, and it's repetitious in its unrepetitiousness, if you like. And for some women, it's very clearly always the full moon or always the dark moon. And the full moon is usually associated with expansion and maybe going outwards and being more active in the world. The dark of the moon is often more of an inward time or of a contemplative time. And I've seen women who started tracking and started paying attention who started ovulating on the full moon and bleeding on the dark moon, and which is really more of an inward time anyway. So we live in calendars, you know, if you think of the Gregorian calendar, it doesn't have any connection with any cycles of nature whatsoever. I mean, it's not connected to any natural cycle. So since nature is cyclical and since women's bodies are cyclical, it makes sense that we would at least try and track and see how can we tune in and live with those cycles rather than against them. So let me stop here for a moment and see if there are any questions or comments or anything that you'd like to say before we...
Have you found any correlations between just emotionally or what it might represent when a woman is bleeding on the new moon versus the full moon?
Emotionally. There is, I think that women who bleed on the new moon feel that it's easier for them to maybe take time or kind of go inward, whereas the full moon is more of an expansive time, and there might be more of an inner kind of a conflict, even though usually the bleeding kind of takes precedence over the fullness of the moon, because it really does call us inward. It's an interesting question, and I think that it also could be very individual from woman to woman.
Yeah,
so, yeah.
Your comment about taking time off for the cycle. A number of years ago, I realized at the death of my parents, my mother, that our culture doesn't really allow for grieving. You know, you have 3 days off, thank you, and then you're supposed to come back to work.
Yeah.
And in traditional cultures, like I'm familiar with East Asian culture because I studied in Korea, they expect grieving to last 3 years when your mother dies. They expect that process to take three full years.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And So when you mentioned that about taking time off, it, that sort of came back to me.
Yes.
And how difficult it is for many people to carve out even a day or two. So I was wondering if you would comment on that.
I think that it's very interesting what you bring here, because in a way the passage of a parent is also a rite of passage. Mm-hmm. And if we look at Western culture, the all of the rites of passage have been kind of wiped out, and grieving is definitely one of them. And there is grief for, you know, various death in our lives, but specifically the death of a parent, I think, is a rite of passage that that is really not acknowledged. So I know that in the Jewish tradition there is a 7-day period where the family is supposed to sit, to not go out or work or do anything ordinary, and people come to you. But after that, again, there is an expectation to go back, and yet there are points in time. So there is the 30th day after the death that you're supposed to go to the cemetery, and then there is the yearly. But the 3-year is interesting. I have not been familiar with that. I'm just struck by that as a rite of passage. When we think of rites of passage, we think of birth, we think of coming of age, puberty, we think of marriage, we think of these days divorce is a rite of passage, you know, a modern rite of passage. But a parent's death is definitely a rite of passage, and it definitely is not honored. So 3 years is really, I think, a sign of a society with time that is not in a hurry anywhere. And we do have that eye on the clock at all times. Women often ask me, you know, well, I work full time, they say, so how can I take the first day off? So yes, even though my recommendation is to take the first day off, or even more than one day if possible, then if you can't, then I would say that what is mostly important is the intention. So if you work full time and you have to be at work at 9, that you get up slightly earlier and you light a candle, that you take an hour in the morning, that you can't take an hour, take 10 minutes, but that there is an intentionality around stopping and acknowledging that this is different. I'm in a different state. I am going inward. I'm exploring my connection in a different way, rather than, again, pretending that this day is like any other day. And yes, it is often a clashing with society, you know, to try and take time when there isn't permission, you know, from your work, from the culture at large. So, any more?
I had forgotten when you talked about the cloth.
Yes.
Rags that when I first got my period, I was living in Europe, and my mother gave me a cloth, and that's all it was at that time. And but you know, she washed all my clothes, and she washed those.
I see.
Also, so I didn't really have the connection.
Yes.
With washing them. But
yes.
It's interesting. I just never thought. I mean, I just never thought about it.
Yeah.
Until we came to the United States, then there was a Kotex, and you wrap it up and throw it away.
Yeah. Yeah.
I haven't seen like special trash cans in certain bathrooms.
Most women's bathrooms have special.
Oh, that's because they don't want you to put a tampon down the toilet.
Yeah.
Or
Well, talking about that, you know, let me bring the environmental impact here, that apart from anything else in terms of our connection with our cycle and the divine at that time, that the disposable menstrual products are the number 2 cloggers of landfill. So number 1 are baby diapers, and number 2 is women's hygiene products. So if you think of the amount of disposable paper product that, you know, and the women of the world just multiplying that, and monthly it's a huge amount of waste. Wow. Yeah.
Number two, the second most common thing found in a landfill.
Mm-hmm. It's the second largest blocker of landfill. Yeah, because I mean it makes sense if you just think of the number of women using it, you know, 50% of the population, and over a span of years, you know, say from 12 to 50 on average every month.
Yeah.
It's pretty staggering the amount of that. So I know that some women come to using cloth rags not from an awareness of the divinity of the cycle, but from an environmental concern. And whichever way you come to it, you know, you arrive at the same place, but it's another angle to arrive to it and to look at it from. Yeah.
Something that this woman, her name's Grandmother Nana Tatis, she's an Apache elder, and actually she just passed away, which is really sad because she carried a lot of the women's teachings. But she spoke about that it was believed that women returning their blood to the earth,
yes,
was actually integral to the health of Gaia, of the whole planet, and that, that when women stopped returning their blood to the earth each month, that men had to shed blood. That part of that transition was like the, you know, it was like this, like the dark side of the earth kind of needing that return of the blood, is that men began to take that on in war. And we do see that transition, you know, from women honoring their cycles and moon blood being seen as this incredible magical tool also of fertility and blessing, and that, you know, honoring women's cycles was integral to the health of the community. So when that stopped happening, that's when war began. And so what she spoke about was that we actually, it's like, you know, upon us to begin returning our blood to the earth through ceremony each month, and even if it's just, you know, a little bit, there's a way that women's cycles connect to the earth cycles in this really important way.
Yeah. It's true. I mean, when women, again, in indigenous cultures were sitting in the moon hats and moon lodges, often they would bleed directly onto the earth, and or to moss, or, you know, various substances that would stay on the earth. So another parallel that I've heard is, yes, the war, but also before that, the animal sacrifice. So again, a way of giving, you know, sacrificing, giving blood to the earth, whereas prior to that, the blood was given freely. And in a way, this is the only blood that is shed without wound, that is shed without hurt, and that it is feeding the earth in both in an etheric way as well as in an actual substance way, because of the nourishment of the substance itself, the nourishment that it has. So I want to move to the girls, because that's a big part of this picture, and you brought it, Sarai. So often women come to me and say, you know, my girl wouldn't talk about it, doesn't want to hear about it. I wasn't welcome, they say, and now I want her to have something different, and I want to do something that she would remember, and she just, you know, kind of doesn't want to hear, doesn't want to know, turns away, goes the other way. Oh, mom. So what's up with that? So that brings me back to that break in the maiden inside of us that wasn't welcome. So on a most simplistic level, we can't really give something that we have not received ourselves. So women are really wanting to give something, but there isn't quite a model, and they don't quite know how. So what I see moms do, very unintentionally, I mean, they really come from a very good, heartfelt intention of welcoming their girls, but it goes something like this: for you it's going to be wonderful, and for you, you're going to be remembering this for the rest of your life. I've never had it, but you will have what I never had. And it's so invasive, really without intention. There's nothing but good intention there. But what happens is that there is an invasiveness or an overbearing that is unconscious, that stems from the fact that there is really a hunger inside of women for that soothing of their own inner maiden that has not been welcomed. And there is a somewhat semi-conscious or even subconscious belief that if I do something for my girl, that would fix something in me. And it doesn't quite work like that, because that intensity is too much for the girls to bear. And the girls are actually very wise to run away, because it's not, that hunger is not theirs to meet. So what I say to women is, first and foremost, if you have a girl coming of age, put her to one side first and look inside of your own coming of age and see what was lacking there, and allow yourself to sit in the company of at least one other woman, if not a circle of women, just one other woman, and start by sharing the story of your first blood. I give talks, and women by and large have not told this story. Women tell stories about recovery from abuse, and women tell stories of how they lost their virginity, and women tell a lot of stories of painful memories in their lives, and yet the story of the first blood is pretty much silent. It's pretty much taboo, and it's a way in which women kind of collaborate with the societal taboo around the topic. So they kind of put it out of mind, and it's kind of in a compartment in their minds, and it's not a live story. And what I find when women share that story is that a huge bonding takes place. And I'm sure, again, looking at men, I'm sure that sharing the stories of how it was when your voice broke and how was that time for you, and I'm sure that there is an array of emotional memories that every man can relate to, because they've been there. And that those stories told much?
You know, not until much later, even between close friends sometimes, I think.
Yeah.
Not until much later in life. And then even when they're told, sometimes I've noticed that there's still a kind of shame that's not really acknowledged or something.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what I see that we have as a generation, the opportunity to be both path finders for ourselves and a model for our young. Because no one did that for us, because we were not welcomed as either girls or boys, we have to do it for each other. We have to do it for each other as adults, and then start creating models for our young. And this is a double task. I mean, in old generations, there was always the generation before you that showed you the way, and then you kind of grew into being welcomed, and then when it was your turn, you knew what to do, and you welcomed those who came behind you. We have a stoppage in that line, so we are really called here to reclaim something that we have not received, in order to become elders, in order to be modeling something to the young generation. But we cannot do that until we reclaim our own. So there is, you know, you asked about eldering. There is, I don't know how many of you are familiar with the Mayan traditions and the Mayan calendar of the archetypes of, there is kind of a parallel astrology, if you like, of 20 glyphs, archetypes that are... are you familiar with the Mayan?
A little bit.
A little bit. So without getting into that too much, one of the significant rites of passage there that is connected with Eldring is age 52. And 52 is the time when the astrological birthday, so the all the astrological alignment that was present at your birth, which would be your Gregorian, you know, your calendar birth, and your Mayan it's called the galactic signature. So your Mayan galactic signature fall on the same day every 52 years. So this alignment doesn't happen more often than that. So then when a person arrives at 52, is a gateway, is considered in that culture a gateway into their elderhood. And what's interesting about that is that they become elders and it is the beginning of their second childhood. So what is connected with eldering, yeah. So it's almost like it goes hand in hand. You become elder, you can't become an elder without accessing childhood within you again. So there is both of them are going hand in hand. So my understanding and my recommendation for eldering and for mentoring, you, Sarai, you spoke about mentoring, which I think is an essential piece. I don't know if you mentioned that word, but you know, being models for girls and boys that are not our biological children, I think is essential. This is something else that we lost with the loss of the traditional rites of passage, because when there were traditional rites of passage, it was the whole community of women that welcomed the girl. It was all the whole community of the boys. The boys went hunting with the men out in the forest. There is a lot of myth and stories in oral tradition about the trials of a young man in their passage into manhood. You familiar with some of that? So again, the boys were welcomed by their kind into the manhood, into the family of men, if you like, and the women into the family of women. And so if you think of the moon huts or the moon lodges, girls who started bleeding, 12-year-old, would sit in circle with women who are all the way to menopause. So it was a multi-generational circle. And the boys would be in circle and would be with the elders when they came of age, when their rites of passage were celebrated, and that was usually not one point in time, but a series of trials and of challenges that invited them to thrive and to kind of push their own envelopes in terms of courage and endurance and so forth. So they were part then of a multi-generational circle of men, of elders. So that was definitely part of a growing up experience of any girl or boy, is that everyone in the tribe is their extended family, their aunts and uncles, whether they're blood related or not. And today we don't have that, and we're kind of very insulated into nuclear families. So what I tend to do in my workshops when I work with mothers and daughters or with women and girls is that I always have some of the exercises where girls pair up with women who are not their moms. And it's really exciting to see what happens. Because here is a woman sitting in front of a girl who did not nag her to do her homework and was not, you know, didn't raise her and doesn't have expectations of her becoming this or that. And there is a freshness to that connection. And vice versa, sitting in front of a girl who doesn't roll her eyes at you and doesn't throw her laundry for you to do, and you don't have that history with. So again, there is a freshness of seeing her in her own right rather than someone that you have history with. So usually something very special takes place and in those exercises. And what is really exciting is that both the women and the girls are then able to transfer that when they go back to their own girls, their own daughters, or their own mothers, that there is a suddenly an ability of seeing their moms as a person, as a woman, or seeing their girls as a young woman rather than as the daughter that she's so used to seeing in a specific way. So I do believe that as a culture we have a task of becoming resources, becoming elders to our young, regardless of whether they are our biological children or not. So part of the invitation to journey into the inner maiden and heal her, and to journey into the inner young man and heal him, is in order to be able to be present for younger people in our midst, not as parents, to really play a role. Because with how we are, with how we be in the world as women or men, we model womanhood and manhood. And if the less conscious we are about our femininity or masculinity, the more we exude that is unconscious to for another generation. So the more we continue the taboo around menstruation, for instance, or the more we continue carrying the negative messages that we have received, then another generation is going to grow with that and take it into adulthood, and it would be their job. Well, it is, I think, up to us, and that we have enough consciousness now going around to say this can stop with us. We don't have to pass on the archaic masculinity and femininity that we've been taught to yet another generation. But again, the missing piece there is that we have to find it within ourselves and to soothe the youngster within us before we can authentically model something to others. And I think that even those who are parents need to probably expand their circle of connection to children that are not their biological kids, and those who are not parents even more so. I became a mom late in life. I really had no interest of being a mother. And I had really close bonds with my friends' children. And it was a satisfying connection for both them and I. You know, it was something that I never had. You know, my parents' friends were always there talking with my parents. They never really came to take me out. And here I was taking a 9, 10, 11-year-old friend, young girl, to have hot chocolate as our date, you know, regardless of the fact that I was friends with their parents. And it was so special, and there was something that was healed in me having that experience, because I have not received that as a young girl. So being able to give that to a young girl was really soothing. So I really believe that we have a responsibility to our young collectively, not as parents, but as a culture, to start bringing to them consciously what does womanhood and manhood mean. So then in the book there is lots of activities for mothers and daughters, as well as for women and girls, that are designed to accompany a girl for a year, the year of coming of age. So we're not talking about just this one highlight of the first blood and celebrating that and then things going back to normal, but to really accompany the coming of age year with different people in a girl's life taking different roles in mentoring and accompanying her through different tasks, through different activities, which are designed to kind of call her to maturity, to call her into new levels of herself. So yeah.
I'm just itching myself.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think it really is an exciting task that we have, and it is kind of switching the focus from the fact that we did not have role models, that we did not have elders and that we have nowhere to draw from. And we can lament that, but the fact that we didn't allows us to reclaim it and recreate it in a way that allows for freedom and allows for choosing from an array of cultural buffets that are available today for us as spiritual traditions, and then to offer that up to the generation of girls and boys that are growing up, because you know they're going to be leading this world somewhere. So if we don't do that, then you know the media does that, and the corporations do that, and they have appalling messages for young girls, you know, in terms of body image, in terms of what does it mean to be a girl, you know, and girls in, you know, we live in kind of a bubble here in West County, but girls in the mainstream pretty much, you know, starve themselves, you know, go through a variety of anorexic, bulimic syndromes and so forth. So there is a lot of, in the absence of conscious role modeling, there is a lot of modeling that's happening through the corporate world and through advertising that is really damaging young girls. So it really is up to us to create a counter balance to that. Let me stop here again. What time is it? Yeah, and see if we might have not only questions but more of a conversation.
So in this book, do you have exercises just for like a woman, not a parent?
Yes. So the book starts with speaking a little bit about my own journey, and then guiding women to journey to their own adolescence. And so that's for women, regardless of whether they're mothers or not, just because by the virtue of having been a girl. And then from there it moves to mothers, daughters, and then it moves through mentoring, inviting women to mentor whether they're mothers or not. And then at the end of the book I have a chapter that talks about my experience when I went back to Israel, which is where I grew up, and had a sacred circle of Palestinian and Jewish women, and the profound effect that this had on all of us, because you know you can't find people that are more polarized or estranged, and yet just telling the story of our first blood created a bond there that really surpassed all of the differences, all of the perceived differences, you know, cultural, religious, political, what have you. And it's really wherever I went, you know, in Europe and anywhere I go, just that simple act of sitting together in a circle of women and sharing the story of our first blood is an amazingly bonding experience. So I definitely would like to encourage you to share that with one other woman or with a group of women, that is kind of the beginning of the journey of healing. Yeah.
Do you feel like your question was addressed from other
heads? Yeah. Yeah, I just became a grandmother last week too. I have a boy who's six, but the girl last week. So, I mean, listening to what you said and talking to other women, because it does fit.
Right.
I'm
really
glad I came and listened to you.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Good.
You taught
me a lot.
Good.
Right. Yeah, I love what you're saying about, and this really resonates really deeply for me, because I've worked with girls a lot and with teenage girls, and I feel like there's still a lot inside of me that's not healed around those ages inside of me. So I'm always really aware of that when I'm working with them, and I think part of it is that I am attracted to do that work because I didn't get to have those experiences, and I think it is really healing and And I think that that's okay, too, for me to receive healing through doing mm-hmm. that work.
Mm-hmm.
And I think also there are ways that there are parts of me that still need that attention in order for me to hold that space
mm-hmm.
for girls in the way that I really want to.
Yeah.
You know, and, like, going back into that place. Like, I've never actually, as you were talking, I realized I've never actually talked with my mom about
mm-hmm.
that time.
Mm-hmm.
Like, except for at that time. But we've never gone back and had a conversation about that.
Yes.
I was thinking it would be really, I'd really like to. I'm going to set the intention to have a conversation with her around, because I actually don't remember a whole lot.
Mm-hmm.
From, I've tried to tell my story before, and I'm like, I kind of remember getting in school, and then I remember coming home, and like I remember very few details around that time.
Yeah.
And I'm curious if she remembers any conversations that we had, or
yeah.
if she remembers how she felt as I was going through that, because
mm-hmm.
my feeling is that she didn't quite know how to handle it, and I wonder if she was having difficult feelings around wishing that she could hold it in a different way from me, or if it didn't affect her at all, or what. So yeah, I just have a lot of questions for my mother
yeah.
actually right now.
Yeah.
And also curious about her first blood and
yes.
what that yeah. was like for her, because I've never heard that story either.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, that is a very bonding experience to hear your mom's first story.
Mm-hmm.
And I do have experience with women who don't have memories or have vague memories around their first blood. The work that I do does a lot of shamanic journeys to that
mm.
time, and memories do come up. And there is more of an ability to reclaim that. So because the memories are, you know, kind of, there is an elasticity to memory, and since we don't remember now, it doesn't mean that we can't access,
mm.
you know, because you have lived those times. So,
yeah.
I actually do have I have a class that started yesterday that is still open for this 1 week. I for a long time I worked mostly locally live, and now I started working much more in the past year on the phone, because women find me on the internet from Australia and from, you know, the East Coast and what have you, and they can't travel, and I can't travel as much as I could, because my family is here, and I have a 10-year-old girl. So I started working on over the phone, and it's really interesting, because for a long time I had a lot of resistance working over the phone, and it then struck me when I had a woman from Mexico that really wanted to work with me, and I realized, you know, that I'm preventing her from having an experience that otherwise she has no access to.
Mm.
She couldn't travel, she didn't have the visa, she couldn't even travel here if she wanted to, and she really needed support. She felt really isolated. So I really shifted from resisting the phone to being willing to make this work available to women who can't travel. So so it's pretty neat, you know, we sit on the phone, and first of all, the environmental impact is zero, you know, we don't have to get in a car or in an airplane. And then we sit on the phone, women have, because we do a lot of guided visualizations, women have either their earphone or a speakerphone, so each one is in her own space with her altar, with her candle that, you know, that I asked them to prepare ahead of time. And then they tune in, and someone is in Canada, and someone is in Oregon, and someone is Sacramento, and someone is in Massachusetts. So it's really neat to realize that we are weaving a web of consciousness really across big geographical ley lines, you know. So so anyway, I have a class that started yesterday. It's 6 weeks, so 5 more weeks. And because not everyone finished sharing at the first round, I decided, they asked whether they can bring friends and so forth, so I decided to keep it open for another week. So it's still open, and then after next Wednesday I'm going to close it. So if you are interested, you can join, and you don't have to travel. So you can, I mean, even though you're local,
mm-hmm.
you can tune in on the phone. And
what time is
that? 1 o'clock our time. Yeah. So that's for 5 more weeks. Yeah, but you know, I have other ones coming. I do have a mailing list if you wanted to know about events and stuff. If you're interested, you can sign up. And I was curious to know whether you felt that there is some opening, or did you feel included this time?
Yeah, I mean, the mentorship is kind of interesting to me.
Yeah.
Just hearing about your views on that and stuff is interesting. I'm working towards becoming a school teacher. And so just hearing this viewpoint is.
Have you ever heard of the Mankind Project?
I think so. It's the guys that go out into the forest and they go camping together. And
I think so. Usually I don't know a whole lot about what they do, but I know a bunch of men who are involved with them who are really amazing men and have received a lot from it. And it seems like if you're interested in this kind of stuff and in the male world, that would be a good place to start. You know, just see if there are any local groups, or go to their website. I'm sure there's a lot of resources there. Did you want to tell
me? Sure.
All right. Any more comments or thoughts or questions?
It seems like, you know, when working with girls who are coming up to their moon sign, that in order to create a healthy, like, I'm tired, my brain's farting. In order to create, like, a healthy progression up to their moon sign and beyond, that, like, it really needs to be, like, the moms are doing their work in synchronicity with the girls.
Yeah.
What I found is I've only been working with girls. I haven't been working with moms because I don't really feel qualified to work with the moms. But it seems like as I'm starting to, I mean, I'm basically starting to vision on some programs that around this area. And what I'm really realizing, even before this talk, is that there needs to be, like, a track for the moms, too.
Yes.
And there needs to be, that's why I asked about parents' involvement. Like, how do we, because it's either, like, because the girls I worked with in the past have been like, I don't want to be around my mom, you know. And they're just, like, totally like, no, I don't want to invite my mom into this, you know. Which is understandable, and because they're really seeking peer time and they're seeking time with their mentors, and but then the moms feel totally estranged and they don't know what we're doing. And so I'm really, like, curious how to create that. And really, I mean, I think it takes a mother to be able to, who's been through that, to be able to hold that space too. So, but I feel like just hearing you talk about the importance of mothers who have young girls. In order to really hold them in that, they need to be going in and healing their little girl,
their
little girl.
So what I offer, the program that I offer is a 3-tier. So I do, you know, the work with the moms, and then the mothers and daughters, and then the daughters, the girls by themselves. And maybe we need to talk, because I do train women to do this work. So I have a curriculum that I've developed, which is of these three stages of working with the mothers and then inviting the girls in. So it's rather than working with the girls and inviting the moms in, which is, it's more like I work with the mothers and then we invite the girls in, you know. So that's different. It's not like the girls have had this bonding and they don't want their moms to trespass, but, and then the third step is to work with the girls by themselves. Otherwise we're creating kind of really more isolation, you know. Here are the girls and here is, you know, so there's the teen center and there's the senior center.
And that's already happening so much. Like, there's so many forces that are pulling moms and daughters apart that is such a and it's such, like, that's like the woman's bond. It's like, you know, that's like quintessential, like becoming a woman. So instead of that time becoming a time when the mom and daughter could really, like, get to the next level of the relationship of bonding, it's often the time when they're, like, furthest away from each other, you know, which I think is just another symptom of
the way that women have been divided in our society to not be sisters and not be collaborators, and the ways that I feel like a lot of what kind of the patriarchal mindset of our country and our world right now does is separates women, because if women are like, you know, really sisters and helping each other, then there's a lot of power there that I think is threatening. So I think that that's like one more symptom of what's happening, is that mothers and daughters are being separated at that time. Have you found that to be like, could you tell like a story about that, or like
about which part?
About the mothers and the daughters working together, or like how that's, what has that, what have you seen that create for the families or for the mothers and daughters?
Since I start with the mothers first, then when the daughters are invited in, when the girls come in, there is already a bonding. The women are there as sisters. They're not there as your mom, but as sisters. And for instance, if we share the story of First Blood, if we share personal stories, then the girls are all of a sudden seeing all the women there as extended family. There isn't that nuclear separation.
They're welcomed into the circle.
Yeah, they are welcomed into the circle. They're welcomed into, in a way, into the red tent or into the moon lodge, you know, into something that has been going on for a while. And then, like I said, I pair them up with other women that are not their mothers. So then, again, there is a freshness and a meeting on a level ground rather than on a mother-daughter. So there is really a lot of seeing each other in new eyes, you know, the mothers, their own daughters, see their own daughters in new eyes, and vice versa, the girls see their moms kind of freshly. So, yeah, it's very touching. It's very touching. I, if you wanted a story, one story that really stayed with me was a girl that paired up with a woman who recently had miscarried. So she already had two boys, the woman had two boys, and she was heartbroken because she really wanted a girl, and she miscarried a girl. So she was really heartbroken, and the girl was 16-year-old, and she recently had an abortion. And the bond that happened between them extended, you know, they continued a friendship outside of the workshop. So there is an opportunity. This is part of the beauty and the magic of multicultural circles, where there isn't the age separation, that really this kind of a bond can take place.
This isn't maybe quite related, but my mother-in-law tells me she's so glad she only had boys, because boys are better than girls. And she repeats this like a mantra, you know, it's like, women aren't as good as men, catty and jealous, and blah, blah, blah. And it's very strange. I don't know, never know what to say to her.
Well, is this your experience?
My own personal?
Yeah.
No.
So that's maybe your only answer, is that your experience is different.
Yeah.
You know, it may have been her experience, but it's not yours.
Right. Just let it go.
Yeah, but speaking the fact that that's not how you experience the world either.
Sounds like there's some real pain inside of her, around her femininity, or her womanhood. Maybe some sort of trauma, you know, that's caused her to turn away from her own womanhood and be proud of it.
Exactly.
Well, it is 9 o'clock, so I think we're gonna call it a day. Well, you're very welcome. My pleasure.
Thank you.
Your pleasure. Thank you.